This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am your host, Rituparna Padgiri, and today I am going to be in conversation with Ina Perinuthuppa. Ina is a postdoctoral researcher in sociology at the University of Turku. Today, we will be discussing her book, Feminist Politics in Neoconservative Russia, an Ethnography of Resistance and Resources, published by the Bristol University Press in 2022. Ina, I welcome you to this interview and I'm very glad to have you here.
Thank you, Rituparna. I'm really happy to be here.
Right. So let me begin by asking you your main motivation behind writing this book. What was it that drove you to, write this book?
That's a good question, since I'm not from Russia. I'm from Finland, the neighboring country. But I had studied Russian during school times and lived in Russia during my university studies. And during those studies stays, I had already kind of paid attention to the gender relations and kind of gender order in Russia. And then when I did my master's, I did it on self-help group in St. Petersburg, and how women in this self-help group kind of turned towards this, we could perhaps call it ultra-femininity in their life in order to kind of solve issues, and how they were demanded a lot in the working life and then also in taking care of the family and finding a husband and so on. So then I became kind of interested in the other side and the feminism and was there such a thing? This was also my interest was also increased by the fact that Russia had turned into towards these more conservative policies in the 2000s. So these were some of the key reasons, I guess. Also, I think Russia has a very interesting feminist history that many might not be that familiar with, and yeah, so those could be some of the reasons why I then wanted to discover feminism in Russia in 2010s.
Thank you very much for that comprehensive response. My next question is kind of related because it draws from the motivation itself. I mean, your book is a very rich, ethnographic work, but I would like to know more about the methods that you have used as well as the sources in this book.
So the book is a feminist ethnography, as I conducted ethnographic fieldwork mainly in St. Petersburg and Moscow in 2015. I did most of the ethnography and then I returned. I actually collaborated with some of the activists and returned many times to kind of visit some key events. So I draw from interviews of 44 activists that I conducted, mainly in 2015. But then a lot of a big part of the material is actually based on online ethnography, since a lot of feminist activism in 2010s took place in digital space and social media due to the kind of political opportunity shrinking in other spaces. So online observations are a big part of the book also.
Right. So you do talk about the feminist movement in Russia, and I would want to know, is it a grassroots-based movement, and how has the movement evolved in the country?
Yes, it's definitely a grassroots-based movement, since the feminists are currently not able to operate on an official level due to the political restrictions and repression of civic sector. So they're not, as one of the activists I interviewed said, welcome to the chambers of power. So they have to operate from outside, kind of from outside official politics. And this is also what I write about in my book, that feminist politics in this way is different kind of politics. They define it in different ways, but that's actually what's always been kind of characteristic to feminist politics, that feminists have redefined what politics is and challenged how politics is defined. So here I refer to the fact that it's not only about official party politics, for example. If we compare this generation of activists that became activated in the 2010s to the earlier generation of feminists or women's activists in the 90s, there's a big difference. As they were in the 90s, they were actually able to at least to some extent lobby and take part in official politics. There was even a political bloc called Women of Russia for a while. So nowadays, this type of action is not possible. There is no dialogue with decision makers. And this makes also the feminist activism a bit more radical, in the sense that they have to operate from outside. And the other thing is that they do not have economic support. Whereas in the 90s, women's organizations were actually supported quite generously from abroad, because it was thought that if feminism and women's organizations are supported, then democracy is supported in Russia. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So could you also talk a little bit about how feminist politics is conducted in neoconservative and authoritarian Russia? Because you did talk about how, you know, feminism was supported when democracy was considered to be intricately connected to it. And what forms does it take in this political context?
So in the book, I suggest that feminism actually takes four key aspects, and these are reparative politics, politics of sheltering, politics of expertise, and politics of appearances. And they are kind of, the book is divided to chapters that discuss these four dimensions. So the first dimension, reparative politics, discusses how feminism is very personal project. And I think this has been throughout history typical for feminism in Russia and elsewhere. It starts from one's own experiences of oppression or patriarchal experiences, and then working on those. But at the same time, it's very political and social. In this part, I discuss how therapeutic and political elements come together, because the activists discuss different types of vulnerabilities. Some have faced gendered violence and want to engage in activism to fight against the culture of cultural violence, as they term it. Others identify as non-heterosexuals and discuss these types of vulnerabilities in the current political context, in which due to laws such as the so-called homopropaganda law in Russia, you cannot be openly express your non-normative sexuality. So these very personal issues come together with the politics. So at the same time as the activists kind of deal with these issues on a personal level, they engage in politics to kind of spread the word and understanding of feminist ideas. And my point in this part is to kind of that it's not possible to separate these two, the therapeutic aspects and the political aspects. And one example would be the feminist. There were, for example, feminist theater festivals during which there were plays on gendered violence. And then following the plays, there would be this discussion where people would share their own experiences of violence, but also kind of aim to spread the word. So they were really entangled, and these spaces would kind of turn into these therapeutic sessions. Well, that was a long explanation on the first one. I'll try to be shorter with the rest. The second dimension, politics of sheltering, argues that you cannot study feminism in such a repressive and authoritarian context as contemporary Russia without taking its spatial aspects into account. So producing feminist spaces is a pivotal task for the feminist activists. And such spaces are produced both for safety, as I mentioned, for therapeutic and reasons, and for those who feel vulnerable in the society, but also in order to kind of create these alternative realities, which we call prefigurative spaces. So, for example, queer skirt parties that I visited in different cities would be an example of such prefigurative spaces in which alternative futures and norms are kind of enacted and tested and lived among the activists. The third dimension, politics of expertise, discovers the centrality of knowledge for the movement. Consciousness raising has been in the kind of heart of feminist activism since the 19th century when feminism first feminist activists appeared in Russia. And the interviews with the activists show how feminist ideas, having access to those, has had an immense effect on them, and how they've been able to, for example, take political agency. So knowledge, I think, is in the center of feminist politics in many ways, but there are also struggles over who gets to be a feminist expert in public. So there are movement internal struggles over knowledge also. And finally, politics of appearance is the fourth dimension, shows and illustrates and discusses what happens to activism in this kind of very repressive context where most of the opportunities for activism are online. And the part looks at how the online reality becomes actually more real than the reality offline, as you cannot, it's made really hard to make demonstrations and so on. So it kind of traces some of the forms activism takes in this kind of context. And I think it's quite relevant, not only in Russia, but everywhere, that authoritarianism is and conservative ideas are gaining space, this final part in particular.
Right. What role does Pussy Riot play in this context? Because it is a very famous and global name. I mean, all over the world, we do hear about them.
Yes, and Pussy Riot is a kind of cultural, they visited even some American popular cultural TV shows, so they're really well known. But even if Pussy Riot is globally, without a doubt, the best known example of Russian feminism, I did not study Pussy Riot. In my study, I wanted to rather show the manifold nature of activism and the many forms feminism takes. So I wanted to interview as many types of feminists I could, and also illustrate the fact that feminists are not unanimous. So there are lots of very different points of view on feminism among feminists, and this becomes also clear as many of the feminists I interviewed actually criticized Pussy Riot a lot, and some might have even said that they are not feminists at all. So here again, it becomes visible that there is this, which is not, I think, only connected to Russia, but a wider phenomena that actually activists, feminists often struggle over what type of feminism is the right kind. And this also connects to what I discussed earlier, the kind of feminist knowledge and the struggles over who gets to be an expert.
One other thing that really interested me was you talking about how reactivity becomes a constraint for the Russian feminist movement. If you could talk a little more about it for our listeners with a few examples, that would be great.
It's nice that you noticed this, and I think it's an important aspect to activism during digital age, but especially feminist in such a challenging context where most of the opportunities are online. So some of the activists I interviewed, feminists, were critical of the fact that activism often takes place as a reaction to something else. So whether a politician says something or there's an article on media on something and then they would respond to that. So this connects to what I discussed about the last I mentioned politics of appearances in my book, and the way actually activists have in many ways adopted the media logic. So they know how to operate in order to receive visibility and get their actions go viral online. But this is also kind of a problem if activism is only about reactivity. So one more example would be that some of the activists who were really skilled in online activism, that is activism that would receive a lot of attention, they would play with the way media often writes about or gets interested about shocking or somehow controversial actions. So they would kind of create these shocking events in order to be interesting enough to be kind of noticed in media or that their post would go viral. And you need to read my book to see some of the most kind of, I think, interesting examples of this kind of actual activism. But let's say, I could share one if we have time, Barna, I'm not sure. One example, even quite confusing for me coming from outside Russia, would be the example where a group of feminists had decided to hijack publicity from a conservative religious group in Russia. So they were supposed to have a demonstration that day in St. Petersburg canals. These pro-lifers who kind of are in many ways on the opposite side to feminists, as they, for example, oppose abortion and so on. So what the activists and the feminists did was hijack their publicity by dressing as the Orthodox activists and renting a boat and then taking pictures and publishing those pictures before the actual Orthodox protest would take place, so that these pictures were then spread online as so the people thought that this was the actual Orthodox protest, even though in reality people would actually realize when looking at the pictures more closely that they were playing with the Orthodox statements, but actually sending a feminist message from in between the lines. This is quite a even for me quite confusing action, but one of the examples of how activists would kind of play with the media logic and have very kind of skilled and creative ways of navigating the challenging context. But talking about reactivity, I think due to the fact that the kind of media and digital reality we all live in, despite where we come from, it's really important to kind of pay attention that not all activism is around, is kind of an answer to someone else. And here I think, for example, the prefigurative spaces I mentioned earlier, where the feminists would create their alternative kind of realities and social relations and live and test them, such as the queer skirt parties, where actually anyone, regardless of their gender and sexuality, would sew their own skirts and dance the night away, are these types of places where that are not based on reactivity, but rather their own needs and what they want to actually, what's their long-time goal and dream for the social movement. I hope I was clear enough with this.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, you also talk about the feminist backlash, and it is also a global phenomenon that we do see in Russia, India, or many other parts of the West as well. So how would be some of the ways in which this oppositions to the feminist movement in Russia are played out? And could you also talk about some of the tactics and strategies that state and other agencies deploy to, you know, resist these movements?
Feminism is belittled and the issues they raise are depoliticized. This happened already with Pussy Riot's Punk Prayer. The attention was directed to different things than they aimed at, the feminist issues they were kind of raising. Rather, discussion was on what they did in the Orthodox space and so on. And they were women behaving in a way that should have women shouldn't behave on. Furthermore, feminists are produced as foreign to the kind of, this is in quotes, the authentic Russian culture. So even if this is not the case, but in the current current political regime wants to kind of return this idea of traditional values and Russia going hand in hand. Even if we kind of, my book shows and many other beautiful researches, books on feminist history show that actually there is a very rich feminist history in Russia. But these are some of the kind of ways to make feminism seem smaller and kind of irrelevant. At the same time, it's obvious that due to the increasing repression and the situation getting even worse in Russia, feminists are indeed viewed as a threat for the political regime. A couple of them have more recently, for example, been given the title of foreign agent. That is a governmental tool to repress non-governmental activism and to threaten individuals or groups with fines or even imprisonment if they continue to engage with activism. So this is one of the examples, very concrete examples of how it is in many ways that also the power holders try to make their work harder, and many activists have had to also leave Russia, and they now operate from abroad.
And how do you think feminist activists make sense of feminism in their lives? What would be some of the resources that they use to fight this backlash?
I think this is a feminism as a lens is a kind of metaphor that I often hear. It's not just in Russia, but the activists in Russia too use the metaphor of a lens. And they say that feminism is a lens to understand oneself and also leave back the patriarchal self. So with the help of feminist knowledge, they have been able to view themselves in another light and see perhaps the heteronormative order they used to live in, and kind of challenge that and start living a different life. The interviews that I did show that feminism has been an immense therapeutic resource for the activists, as they have both kind of been able to help themselves and others, but also take political agency. And when talking about the resources, it's a good question. And one of the key themes in my book, actually the question of resourceful activists was what I wanted to study in this book, as one person I encountered during my fieldworks talked about resourceful feminists. And this puzzled me as the activists often lacked economic resources. But via my ethnography, I discovered that the key resources that feminists do have access to are indeed feminist knowledge, as well as media-related resources, that is, the ability to create these media appearances that then go viral and bring lots of visibility to feminism. And this connects to the fact that most of the political opportunities are online and in social media in Russia, and these resources thus matter a lot. And this also increases the struggles between feminists, as some activists become more visible than others, and this enables them to become celebrity activists who then can accumulate even economic resources and have a lot of discursive power. But at the same time, we must not forget the activists who are not that visible but do a lot of important work in kind of this invisible space. So I'll talk a lot about this invisible-visible dimension and the kind of aspects. So feminism takes many very spectacular and very visible dimensions in Russia, but also hides for many reasons that are, I think, very important to discover.
I was going to ask you about what role resources play in the Russian feminist movement, but I think you've already, you know, answered the question.
I think so, yeah.
Yes. Right. So, last question, Nina. I know that, you know, you use ethnography extensively, and it is a very interesting method that sociologists use. But are there any challenges that you also faced during the data collection process? I would also want to know, because you do have a section on this in your book, about what kind of special attention you gave in order to maintain ethical clarity while doing this work. Because in the recent years, ethnography and, you know, there are debates on how ethical standards need to be maintained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really important question. I'll first answer the first one, which was on the challenges, I guess. There were moments I had to think and kind of stop and think, should I be in a place? There were festivals. I took part in festivals that then would be kind of closed down by police. And at times I decided to leave a place. I decided I shouldn't be somewhere. But these were kind of, there were these moments where I wasn't sure. Should I stay because it would be good for the research, but then also to think about my own safety and navigate the kind of feel that was not that familiar to me. But overall, I was not the one in the challenging position. The feminists and the activists who take many risks because of their commitment to feminism are, and also their kind of positions vary in many ways. Some are more vulnerable because of their, say, non-heterosexuality or other types of things than others, or ethnicity, for example. So I think activism is consuming everywhere, but in this type of repressive context, it becomes really challenging and consuming. And I think we need to discuss, or it's really important to kind of discuss what would then be kind of sustainable activism in these types of contexts and everywhere. About the ethical clarity, it's truly a really important question that has to be always in the core of any research. And I think it is I was conducting feminist ethnography, which kind of always focuses on making visible all power relations and positionalities, which is, I think, very useful tool, and also being really aware of the researcher's kind of privilege and position. I think this is a good tool for being aware all the time, being aware of the different power relations and hierarchies and making them visible. Some of the issues I had to work through and consider were questions such as, who do I want to give a voice? And what I wanted to do was to interview as different activists as possible, from who identified with different schools of feminism, and both those who were really visible, but then the ones that were not, and perhaps looking for reasons why they were not visible. I also wanted to avoid romanticizing the feminist movement and instead show the movement internal frictions and struggles too, because I think activism is always about tension and struggles. So it would be easy to romanticize feminist movement, since I am myself a feminist and of course admire what they're doing. But I think it's important to also look at the internal relations in a critical, from a critical aspect. But yeah, at the end of the day, the most important thing, I guess, is that these activists whom I really admire because of all their important work gave their time to me and shared their stories with me. So I wanted to show them as agents, at least trying to make a difference in their life, even if this is really challenging at this point or in the 2010s. And one thing I perhaps didn't say, that in the 2010s, there was still this alternative media online in Russia, which does not exist anymore after the invasion of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as some of the laws have become even more strict. So many of the things I write about in the book are not possible anymore in the extent that they were.
Well, thank you so much, Ina, for this lovely conversation. I absolutely enjoyed reading your book, and I'm sure that after listening to this podcast, a lot of other readers will also pick up your book. So thank you once again for doing this for New Books Network.
Thank you so much, Rituparna. It was a true joy to discuss with you.